anything about munching on dog yet.
No, they have not.
Well, I could talk to you about eating the delicious dog stew.
Where did you eat this dog stew?
In rural China.
Disgusting.
Well, why? I kind of object to the whole premise that there are disgusting foods and non-disgusting foods.
He's right.
What do you mean? Some taste good and some don't.
Well, I mean...
Yeah, that's a taste thing, but you're placing a value judgment
on what are correct foods to eat
and what are
incorrect. No, I didn't say it was incorrect. I said it sounded disgusting.
Oh, but if you're Indian, then cow is disgusting, but if you're American, it means
yes,
you're patriotic.
Yes, you are correct.
Yes, food tastes are culturally...
I'm not arguing that point.
When I was visiting my friend in China, you know, they were trying to share their cultural experience with me, and I was, you know, all for that. And in the winter, you eat dog stew because, as you know, dog has a warming effect on the human body.
I didn't know that.
And when you're cold, you really want to eat foods that help you stay warm.
Okay. When you want to close the door, frankly, there's people talking in the next room. Can you believe
shut
it?
Shut up.
One nice thing about this restaurant we went to for the dog stew is that, you know, those like thin paper coverings for the chopsticks? They had a picture of a little happy dog in a top hat.
I'm sorry. I was distracted by Frankie. A picture of a little happy dog in a top hat. And that was
on the cover for the sanitary cover for the chopsticks in this restaurant.
In the restaurant that serves dog stew.
A dog with a top hat?
Yeah, it was a happy dog.
That's cute.
It's one of the few things I saved, one of the little paper ephemera things that I saved from that trip.
Could you send us
a photo of that?
Yeah, I kind of want to see it.
I'd be happy to.
I'd love to put that on the blog. Yeah, you can email us at shutupweirdo@wfmu.org.
Okay.
All of you can write us there.
I'll get right on that. And remember, there's no disgusting foods. There's only delicious foods and foods that other people don't like.
Mole sauce is disgusting.
I like mole sauce.
So is pesto.
It's made with chocolate.
Yuck.
Spilled oyster sauce in the summer is really pushing it.
Okay, have a good one, Mr. Dog Eater.
Woof.
That was cute.
I suppose there's food that makes you sick. Hey, look at the time, Frank.
You know who it was out there talking to Lad? Station manager Ken. Don't you think he should know better?
Yeah, he should know better. Although maybe we should have closed the door in the first place.
No, maybe he should just
That's why the studio has soundproof doors, so you can close them.
FMU, you're on the radio. Hello.
Hey, yeah. So my name's Charlie. I was once in Kyrgyzstan, and I had something called kumis, which is fermented horse milk. It was gross.
Ugh.
How gross was it?
Wait, but there's no food that's gross. It's just a matter of taste.
It really tasted like vomit. It was just terrible.
Vomit. Okay.
Yum.
Okay, what's worse, vomit or sewage?
I don't know. We should have a whole show about that. All right.
What was amazing to me is that people were selling it on the streets and people were buying it like soda.
Like it was like yum, yum, delicious.
Yum, yum, delicious. Right.
Okay, thanks for calling. Have a good one.
People are probably disgusted by the acorns that they sell here on the street. What
FMU,
do they sell?
You're on the radio.
Chestnuts, sorry.
I hope that's me.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I only been listening for the past 20 minutes, unfortunately. But when I was living in England, we had these things called pork scratching.
Pork scratching?
They're like the things that pork rinds rejected.
Oh! I love pork rinds.
Really?
So good.
Pork rinds are disgusting.
You're disgusting.
You know what they are, right?
There's no such thing as a disgusting food.
Okay, they are disgusting to me.
Okay, thank
happy
you.
Now?
Thank you.
I don't want to pass a law against pork rinds. Well,
what are they?
Pork rinds? It's like they take the skin and they cut it into pieces and then they fry it up. And it's like pig skin potato chips instead of potatoes. Very high in things that are bad for you.
FMU, you're on the radio.
Yeah, you guys still talking about eating weird stuff.
Unfortunately, we are.
Oh, of course. Well, right here in Chinatown.
Yeah.
My father-in-law grew up in Chinatown, and my mother-in-law and I are the only two Irish people in the family. And we go to weddings here and there, and my father-in-law always counts on me to join him in the traditional eating, which I'm really not so into, but I like to stay on the good side.
Mm-hmm.
But there's these baby octopus. They're like whole baby octopus, and they have their faces are on them still. And they're like little and red, and they're just like full octopus shape. And he likes to eat the face first. And they also eat jellyfish, which looks like spaghetti. And it, like, it's so weird. It, like, pops in your mouth. It's, like, all these little blisters of, like, weird, like, tentacles.
So it's, like, sticking to the inside of your mouth with
the tentacles.
But
it's the tentacles, right?
No, it's the tentacles. And they look like spaghetti. They look like a kind of thick pasta. But, like, when you chew it, it, like, pops in your mouth. It's absolutely strange. And everything is super ridiculously salty. I mean, it's not super disgusting, except for my father-in-law, like, bites the little face off the little baby octopus.
That's amazing and disgusting.
Pretend I'm on, like, Man vs. Wild, and okay. That's what you have to do.
All right, thanks for calling, mister. Have a good one.
Okay.
Yeah, so, thanks.
So, was that our last call, Frangry?
One more. And then I'll announce my winner.
You're pushing your luck, okay.
What time is it?
It's 58. 2 minutes to go.
Oh.
Before the big switchover.
Hi, you're on the air. Give it to us quick.
Okay, so I ate a fillet of fish at McDonald's about 30 years ago. It had a big, giant piece of jagged yellow glass in it. I brought it to the counter. I said, this was in my fillet of fish. So no, we're really sorry. Here's a certificate for another one.
Yay! Like you would want to eat another one.
Believe that was the very last time I ever ate fast food.
Yum. All right, thanks for calling. Have a good one.
Bye-bye.
Okay, and now it is time to sift through all the disgusting things we've heard.
There is no question
to me
as
to you.
Who my winner is. It
really?
Is unanimous. There is absolutely no competition. Jill, my friend, you have won yourself the new design of the Shut Up Weirdo t-shirt. Email me your size and address at shutupweirdo@wfmu.org. O-R-G.
I promise it will handsomely complement your existing Shut Up Weirdo Prize t-shirt.
For those of you who didn't hear her call, she ate human ashes. Yay!
From her late friend.
Yay!
He's okay. A part of her now.
It's your turn now.
Okay. What am I supposed to do? I guess I should remind people that you have been listening to Shut Up Weirdo, and you can comment during the show at WFMU.org. We have a website, shutupweirdo.com, with links to our pages on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes. I'm Andy.
I'm Frangry.
Up next is Stuff You Should Know. Mr. Fine Wine will be in at 8 p.m. Not yet, but wait an hour. You are listening to The Great One, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, live and archived at WFMU.org. So let's...
End it here.
Chuck and Josh and Stuff You Should Know, the program that breaks knowledge down into radio-friendly, bite-sized nuggets. This is the radio version of the Stuff You Should Know podcast, which is available from HowStuffWorks.com. Tonight, Chuck and Josh explore the world of exploitation films, and then, in part two, they look a little bit too thoroughly at obsessive-compulsive disorder. Now here's Chuck and Josh.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. There's Charles W. Chuck Bryant. This is Stuff You Should Know, the podcast, and kind of a special edition, frankly. I am a little excited, Chuck. I'm a little giddy.
Shut your mouth.
Okay, sure.
All right.
This is our first ever movie-centric podcast, right?
Movie-centric, for sure, yeah. We've mentioned... movies, of course, all the time, but this one is like...
This is all about movies.
Yeah.
So this is by popular request to an extent. People want to see, like, they want to hear us talk about movies and just do a movie podcast, so we decided to focus on exploitation films.
That's right.
This is also probably the first podcast that we're going to say, if you are a teacher of children in eighth grade or younger, and you're using this as a teaching tool, you might want to... go to the one before this or the one after.
Yeah.
We don't generally try to alienate audiences. We're not attempting to now. It's just a natural byproduct of the exploitation film.
Can't talk about exploitation films without talking about some lurid subject matter.
Yeah. You can't say exploitation without ploit.
Yeah. They weren't exploiting just people being nice.
Right.
Nice exploitation.
So, Chuck, I went and saw a movie the other day called I Saw the Devil. It's a Korean movie. It's by the guy who did The Tale of Two Sisters, I think.
Oh, you said more violent than Old Boy?
Yeah. The guy, Old Boy is one of the main characters. And I've seen Old Boy. I've seen... what's the other one he did? The vampire movie?
Yeah.
Thirst?
I didn't see that one.
I think it's pretty good. It was okay. This one is, it's the most violent thing I've ever seen in my life. It's the most graphically violent movie I've ever seen in my life. The only reason it, like, I was able to complete is because I'm like, it's a movie. I know.
Right.
But I walked out of it like, it's so over the top. It's so gory.
Right.
It's clearly an exploitation film.
Yeah. Alive and well.
Yeah, but the problem is like, really, if you start to look around, John Hughes films technically are exploitation films. The Breakfast Club is technically an exploitation film.
Yeah, there was a big wave of teen exploitation films,
mm-hmm.
and we'll get to that, but yeah, you're right.
So one of the broader definitions of exploitation films is basically anything that's really like over the top, that is beyond reality, or that maybe focuses on people's fears,
mm-hmm.
Their sexuality,
yeah,
and basically just kind of serves it up in a larger than life manner. That's one way of looking at exploitation films.
Yeah, you're basically, they're exploiting some of the seedier aspects of humanity most times.
Sure, like murder or sex, like weird sex, that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Sex,
drugs,
weird sex,
teenagers rebelling against parents.
Sure,
that kind of thing.
Like weird science. Have you ever been to a party where a couch shot out of the chimney and into the pond? I mean, it's a pretty nice party. I don't think it's ever really happened, you know?
Yeah.
So that's the vast definition of exploitation. But you and I are kind of qualified to teach a cinema class at, like, maybe a low-level community college.
Yeah.
At this point, after the amount of research we've done in this.
Sure.
And we found that academically, there's a much more distinct... definition for exploitation, and it's seemingly interchangeable term, grindhouse, right?
Yeah, is there a definition?
It's more like a time frame.
Okay.
So from like 1919, mm-hmm. when they really first started making movies, to I think 1959, when the Hays Act went away.
Yeah, well,
that was exploitation. And then after that, it became grindhouse.
Okay. Gotcha.
It's my understanding.
Okay.
So let's do this.
All right. Well, that's the old joke, was that in the awesome documentary American Grindhouse, which documents this era of filmmaking,
yeah.
The old joke, one of the guys says, is that exploitation films began 5 minutes after the camera was invented, motion picture camera.
Because the guy was like, the director was like to his girlfriend, hey, would you mind taking your clothes off for the camera?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it says something about the human condition that you invent the film camera and the first moving images were often lurid. Edison's film, it showed clips of like decapitations and violence and guys fighting,
yeah,
and naked women as film tests. So it's just, that says a lot about people. Like, all right, now we know how to capture things, so let's capture sex and violence.
Right.
First.
Right. And although that really kind of jibed with public taste, or at least public fascination, it didn't jibe with the prevailing standards, the agreed upon standards, right?
Right. I think you said 1919, but the first exploitation film was 1913.
Oh, okay.
Traffic in Souls,
mm-hmm.
or While New York Sleeps.
Right.
And that, like you said, exploitation often plays into fears. That played into the fear at the time of the white slave trade.
Right.
Budget of $57,000 and gross $450,000, which 1913 is a lot of dough.
That is a ton of dough.
And that was Universal Pictures, and they went, hey, kind of onto something here.
Right. After that was released, the Hays Code, Will Hays was the Postmaster General and Presbyterian Elder, and he was making $100,000 a year during the Depression.
That's unbelievable.
Right? He basically said, like, look, we need to apply some moral standards to filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
There's decapitation, there's naked breasts, there's white slavery. Like, we need to pure this up.
Right. Well, actually, there wasn't nudity yet. Like those early test films, there were, but nudity, we'll get to that later.
Okay.
But yes, that's what Hayes tried to do. And like Prohibition didn't exactly quell drinking, the Hayes Code actually sort of gave rise to the exploitation movement.
Yeah, it's just like Prohibition, just like marijuana prohibition, just like, well, any drug prohibition. Anytime you say you can't do this, you can't have something that you want, somebody else is going to operate in a black market. A black market's going to spring up. Simple economics.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened, and that's where exploitation cinema came up. It's like, you can't get this from Hollywood, because Hollywood has to play by the rules, but my production studio is my Model T, and let's go make this movie. Give me some money. I'm going to film a child being born close up and put it in the movies.
Yes. And you can do that. You can make your movies all day long, but if they're never exhibited, then what good are you doing? Or not, like they were trying to do some good, but you're not making any scratch. So the 40 Thieves they talk about in the documentary were these filmmakers and exhibitors basically that traveled around like carnies setting up these sort of guerrilla film screenings in some places sort of out of the way where they can't get caught. And that was for the first time, you know, they were taking films outside of the mainstream.
Yeah.
Different. Sometimes they weren't even theaters. They would show them in like VFW halls. And if you want to go see Birth of a Baby films, apparently they were popular.
Yeah, that was a whole genre, early genre of exploitation.
Well, and so was early on a lot of the films centered around like How to Wear a Condom and these sex hygiene films.
Yeah, because there was no information about that out there. And so exploitation filmmakers, whether disingenuously or genuinely, we're presenting their stuff like, this is a public service. People need to know this.
Right.
And making movies about it. But it also, and people were going on that excuse as well. Like, well, I need to know about this. But at the same time, it's like, I want to see this, the craziest thing I'll ever see in my life.
Exactly.
You know, right. On screen.
Or they argued a lot of times that they were cautionary tales. If they were about drugs or violence, they would say, hey, this could happen to you.
Yeah.
So you should educate yourself. But what they really want to do is get their movie seen.
And make some money.
Exactly. Paramount decision of 1948. This is pretty big. The Supreme Court voted that movie studios could no longer own their own movie theaters. At the time, you know, there would be like the Paramount Theater in Hollywood from the Paramount Film Production Company.
Right.
They would show their movies.
Right.
Supreme Court said no more. And all of a sudden, exploitation films became a little bit more legit because the Hays Code kind of fell apart.
Yeah.
And this is post-World War II, so
people had seen a lot of death recently.
Well, a lot of death, and then
grown up a little more.
They thought ladies in suggestive roles were good for morale, and there was a little bit of loosening on the sex thing. A little bit, post-World War II.
And
enough.
That led to another subgenre of exploitation film, the nudist colony film, which were pawned off as documentaries. Most of these were pawned off as documentaries, which legitimized them. But really, it was maybe it actually was filmed at a nudist camp. Probably not.
Right.
Mostly there were actors and actresses just engaged in archery naked or long walks naked.
Yeah, there could be no sex still. That was still taboo.
But it was just like naked pretty people.
Right.
At a nudist colony, which is interesting because you're not a nudist, so come learn about them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
After that, through the history, we had things like the teen rebellion of the 50s with Rebel Without a Cause and Blackboard Jungle and movies like that all of a sudden were targeted specifically at teens, which was new. And then drive-in theaters were built so teenagers could see movies where their parents weren't going to be. Apparently, the adults didn't go to the drive-ins a lot at first.
Oh, yeah.
It was all kids.
I didn't know that.
So they showed exploitation films and then later the beach films, which were marketed
like
as it's silly, it's Frankie Avalon, but they were decidedly weird and overtly sexual sometimes.
And then Chuck, if you'll notice, we're kind of progressing along in this chronological order, and each thing is kind of being built on the last.
It was very much a step process.
Right. And apparently that was kind of the form that exploitation filmmaking followed until 1960. It was centered around drugs, violence, sex, and in a lot of ways they were presented as documentaries. They might not have a plot.
Right.
And basically it was one person would make some film and it would just break all the rules, and then a bunch of other people would make similar films.
Right.
And the same, that was the way it went. And then in the 1960s, things just started to go every which way, all sorts of directions, right? So yeah. nudity films were a long-standing thread of exploitation films.
Yeah.
And then they probably reached their pinnacle with Russ Meyers, right? King of the nudies is what he's called.
Yeah, he was the first guy to – he's significant because he was the first director to have films featuring nudity that actually were dramatic narratives and had plots and characters, and they weren't classified as documentaries anymore. And then the Ruffies came along, and they offered up violence for the – not first time, but big time for the first time.
Right.
And that has a lot to do with the fact that it was the 60s, and Kennedy was shot, and the United States was just becoming increasingly violent.
America lost its innocence.
Yeah.
And the other thing that really happened in the 1960s was the Hays Code officially went away, was replaced by the MPAA, and the long-standing prohibition on Hollywood producing exploitation films was it was lessened, decreased.
Yes.
And so studios were like, oh, we can make money over here too? Well, let's start making exploitation films.
Right.
And this is where Grindhouse is born. So my cinema professor definition of Grindhouse is big-budget, studio-backed exploitation films.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
That's mine.
I like it.
That's going to be a quiz question later.
Yeah, I'll go with that. Actually, back up one second. We got to mention Herschel Gordon Lewis. He was a director who had a co-director. I can't remember the other guy's name. Do you? Anyway, he was a co-director, and he was one of these exploitation guys that was getting frustrated because there weren't a lot of places to show your movie, so it was a pretty crowded marketplace.
Yeah.
So he said, what's the one taboo that like people will pay to see that you're allowed to show in theaters but that studios won't make? And it was gore.
Oh, yeah.
He was the first guy to start showing really disgusting, bloody scenes in his movie...
Blood Feast. Yeah.
Which actually was 3 years after Psycho, and Psycho also did a lot for the mainstream ushering in of...
Sure.
A little bit of gore in that, but
well, there's
nothing
like
Blood Feast.
A shot of blood following Janet Leigh's murder.
That's right.
You know, which is, I imagine is pretty graphic for Hollywood.
Right.
And that's what you think of. You're like, oh, those stupid 60s. But that's, you know, they're so naive.
Yeah.
Like, that was controversial. Not really, though. Like, if you step just slightly outside of Hollywood, you ran into things like Blood Feast.
Right.
Or, you know.
Last House on the Left.
Yes. Well, that's 1972, I think.
Yeah, Wes Craven. So that was important because all of a sudden, drugs started, three things. Political themes started popping up.
Right.
Sexual freedom, the youth generation.
Mm-hmm.
Drugs started popping up in movies for the first time. Drug use. Well, not for the first time.
No.
We'll talk about Reefer Madness.
Yeah.
But teenagers were depicted as victims of violence for the first time. Like, Last House on the Left, I believe, is kind of regarded as the first teen slasher film.
Yeah.
Wes Craven.
It was almost a snuff film. It was almost regarded like that.
It's pretty hardcore.
But yeah, it definitely, Blood Feast definitely allowed Last House on the Left to come around, but it also probably more directly formed the foundation for slasher exploitation like Friday the 13th or Nightmare on Elm Street.
Absolutely.
My Bloody Valentine's another big one. The Crazies.
On your grave.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
The Crazies. Oh, yeah, that was an original, right? There's a remake now, I think.
Yeah.
Eh.
Yeah.
Remakes. So that brings us, we're in the 70s, politically charged movies brought race into to the mix, and all of a sudden we had black exploitation or blaxploitation movement starting, exploiting the civil rights movement, basically.
Yeah.
But the cool thing about blaxploitation films is for the first time you had African Americans as heroes.
Yeah, and not heroes in a typical sense, not even anti-heroes, but heroes that were like... They didn't ride into town on a white horse or wearing a white hat.
Right.
They very clearly wore black hats if need be. Like, they would engage in crime. They would murder people if need be. They were they were basically like the face of black America coming out of the civil rights era. Like, we're ticked off.
Yeah.
You know?
And we're going to stick it to the white man.
Stick it to the man.
And we're going
to
do it in these movies.
Chuck, I know the movie you're about to mention. This is it.
All right. You keep the faith in me, and you my man. You my favorite man. Can you take it, baby?
So, yes, that was a landmark film for a lot of reasons. One, because it grossed $4 million.
Mm-hmm.
And it made the major studio say, hey, you know what? The Black Hero is marketable.
Yeah. Well, you haven't said the title yet.
Oh, I didn't?
No.
Okay.
And you got to say it right, too.
Melvin Van Peebles film, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song.
Nice. Yep. That was well done. That was 1971. Melvin Van Peebles, whose last name may sound familiar, he's the father of Mario Van Peebles, for you younger cats listening to this one.
Cats our age, actually. Younger cats, because he's kind of like...
Okay, so cats our age.
He's a little washed up.
Yeah, that's Mario Van Peebles' dad, you know, New Jack City.
Yeah, exactly.
So Melvin Van Peebles made this movie. He produced it. He raised the money for it. He wrote it. He directed it. He starred in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the beginning of the blaxploitation subgenre, which is one of the most important genres of any American cinema.
Absolutely.
Ever.
Absolutely.
And so considering how important that subgenre is, this quote from Time Magazine's film critic Richard Corliss should really hit home. Sweet Sweetback is, quote, without question or competition, the most influential movie by a black filmmaker. So this is a really big deal, right?
Yeah, and it was just quickly on the plot. It was about a black man who was a gigolo.
Which is a male prostitute for you younger cats.
And he had a deal worked out with the cops where he said, you know, you can arrest me as much as you want, release me right afterward, fill your quota, it's all good. And then one day, while the arrest is going down, the cops attack a Black Panther,
mm-hmm.
and Sweet Sweetback kills one of the cops,
mm-hmm.
and then just says, he just goes on a rampage against the white man after that.
Yep. So you've got prostitution, tons and tons of nudity and sex. Lots of violence, and other crimes, all wrapped up into a black power theme.
That's right.
And then to top it all off, you have what is arguably a child sex scene starring Mario Van Peebles, Melvin Van Peebles'
right.
son,
uh-huh.
at I think age 6.
Yeah, he's a kid.
Having sex as Sweet Sweetback. It's his
kid.
First sexual encounter with an older person.
Right.
And in the cult podcast, if he became a cult leader, he would have taken a younger bride, remember?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So if you're interested in that movie and you can't get enough of Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, you could also check out Badass! Exclamation point, which is Mario Van Peebles' biopic about his father making that movie.
That's right, and I have not seen that, but I wanted to at the time, and it just sort of slipped through the cracks.
There's always Netflix, baby.
That's right. What happened with Sweet Sweetback was that, like I said, that told the studios, hey, we can market this. And so they got a little more mainstream with movies like Superfly,
mm-hmm.
which were a little safer.
Shaft.
Shaft, movies that wide audiences would enjoy as well.
Yeah, the ones that didn't scare the man.
Exactly.
Like, Shaft's a good guy. He doesn't take any guff from the man, but the people he's not taking guff from are the cops, who he's really on the same side as.
That's right.
So, Chuck, blaxploitation, obviously huge. It affected everything from, you know, Menace to Society to Blackula.
Yeah.
All of that came from Sweet Sweetback. And we mentioned the guy who directed this next movie, Russ Meyers. This is probably a seminal work. Let's listen to this clip from the trailer.
If you want one, ladies and gentlemen, go for a wild, wild ride with the Watusi cats. But beware, the sweetest kittens have the sharpest claws. For your own safety, see faster, pussycat. Kill. Wild women, wild wheels. Race the fastest pussycats, and they'll beat you to death. Superwoman, belted, buckled, and booted.
Yourself on this kid and hanging it up for nothing.
For nothing? It's got nothing to do with the money. She has the money.
Jack and Jill, they make the mafia look like brownies.
Hey, he's a big one, ain't he?
They make the mafia look like brownies.
That's right. That says quite a bit about them. So that was Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill. In 1965, Russ Meyer's women exploitation film, nudie film. So remember, Russ Meyer's was king of the nudies.
King of nudies.
He made 26 movies, but this is probably, at the very least, his best known, if not like his masterpiece.
Yeah, and he hatched a slew of, not that he wasn't legit, he was, but what mainstream people would call legit filmmakers came up through the Russ Meyer film camp, basically.
Yeah.
So it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Russ Meyer also, little known fact, another movie that's mentioned in this article. There's an article on the site, by the way, called 10 Noteworthy Exploitation Films that this is based on.
Yeah. Written by you.
Yeah. Which I strongly recommend going to read because it has a lot of extra stuff we're not going to cover in this one.
Yeah.
Or at least extra movies. But Russ Meyer directed a movie called Beyond the Valley of the Dolls 2.
Right.
Which was the bastard son of the legitimate film Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. It was a jiggle fest written by none other than Roger Ebert.
That's right.
Yeah.
Only movie Roger Ebert ever wrote.
Yeah, and he had it was a very brief career, but that's an illustrious one, really.
So if you're going to talk about the plot of Faster Pussycat, Kill, Kill! And I say that because there's three exclamation points.
Faster Pussycat.
And a comma.
Exclamation point, Kill.
Oh, no, is it three exclamation points?
Yeah.
Okay, I thought it was a comma, then two. All right, either way, that's a lot of punctuation for a film title.
Right.
And it was about three bisexual go-go dancers. They go on a crime spree out in the desert. And what do? They end up killing a man and a... Or no, they kill the man and a couple.
Keep the girl. They basically empower her.
Yeah, say, come on with
by
us.
By murdering her boyfriend, and she ends up on the crime spree with them.
And they basically end up going to an isolated house with a wheelchair-bound old man and his sons.
Oh, who's a lech. They're all leches. They want these women.
Yeah, but they don't know that these women are tough.
No.
Tough ladies.
And the man and his sons apparently or allegedly have a large amount of cash stashed in this house. So it's kind of like a standoff of gall to see who will come out on top. You know?
Well, and you know who comes out on top.
Yeah.
And this film was noteworthy for one big reason was that there was a lot of dualism toward gender. So on one hand, he's exploiting these women and apparently got women in their first trimester of pregnancy, so they were more voluptuous.
Yeah, not in this film, but in his other films, he would hire, I can't remember the lady's name, but the star of Faster Pussycat Kill Kill was in other Russ Meyer's films.
Gotcha.
And he made sure that she was like well into her first trimester to enhance her natural bustiness.
That's right.
Yeah.
Her bosom, if you will. But the script, like I said, it was dualism because while he did that, it also empowered women because the women in his films bowed to no man.
No.
They were the champs. They were they were heroines, really, for the first time.
But they were objectified very clearly, but at the same time, if you follow the script and really look at their characters, then, yeah, they're powerful women.
And this kind of kicked off a big slew of women exploitation films, sexploitation films. The women in prison movies.
Yes, Switchblade Sisters.
Very big at the time. Women were lead actors for the first time. They were aggressors for the first time. Still nude, often while they were doing this stuff.
Spawned the television show The Facts of Life.
But the interesting thing is they found that these movies appealed to men and women because men would go see it for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
Women would go see it because it was empowering and they didn't mind, you know, looking at the naked ladies because women are much more grown up than men are.
Yeah.
But, Josh, the 70s also got a little schlocky, which in a sense was true to the exploitation model.
Yeah.
They really went over the top. No more political statements, no more advancing of women's gender or African Americans. It just got really schlocky and outrageous at that point.
Well, what happened, starting in the 60s, but really took hold in the 70s, and then from that point on, was exploitation cinema early on showing a live birth, nudist camps. These were all geared toward adults.
Yeah.
In the 60s and then later on big time in the 70s, the audience became almost exclusively teenagers.
Right.
Like those drive-in teenagers or... teenagers anywhere. Who cares? But the audience was teenagers, and the cast started to become teenagers. So it had a little more of a bent on what teenagers were having to deal with, like bullying, like the kid in this next clip, right? Which is, I have to say, one of my favorite movies from way, way back.
Here we go with Toxic Avenger.
Yeah.
Meet little Melvin. He's a 90-pound weakling. Everyone hated Melvin.
Yeah, I'm going to take this mop and shove it down your throat.
They teased him.
I want to do it with you.
Okay.
They taunted him. They tormented him until he had a horrifying accident and fell into a vat of nuclear waste, transforming little Melvin into a hideously deformed creature of superhuman size and strength. Melvin became the Toxic Avenger.
So Josh, the Toxic Avenger movie was unique in that its film production company, Troma, is very popular in their own right.
Have you ever seen Surf Nazis Must Die?
I haven't, but I know it's about Troma. I mean, they are master self-promoters and marketeers.
They were one of the first production companies to have a website.
Oh, really?
Like a really comprehensive website. You should go on their website.
I like that.
Their whole catalog, it's really just well done. It's schlocky, but it's well done.
Right. And Toxic Avenger follows the story of a 98-pound weakling who was picked on, released the same year as Ghostbusters.
Mm-hmm.
Did you notice that? 1984, right?
Yeah, so it occurred at 0 year.
At year zero.
Yeah.
We'll just put the null set to represent that. And this kid gets pushed out of a window into a vat of toxic sludge.
Which, that's beyond bullying, really.
Yeah, I mean, basically it's a more twisted version of Modern Problems, the Chevy Chase film from a couple of years earlier.
Okay. I haven't seen that one.
Oh, you never saw Modern Problems?
No.
It's very silly. But he got toxic sludge dumped on him and had special powers.
From years earlier or prior? Or after?
When was the movie?
Yeah.
It was 2 years before Toxic Avenger.
Huh.
But Toxic Avenger took it into a gore special effects way that Modern Problems never did.
So the janitor, Melvin, I believe his name is, becomes toxified. He becomes Toxie. The Toxic Avenger, who beats the tar out of people at the health club where he was abused and mutated, and has tons of sex as the Toxic Avenger because his newfound manhood is just irresistible to women. And one of the things that's noteworthy about the Toxic Avenger is that they actually tried to make decent effects.
Yeah.
It wasn't horrible, I guess you could say.
Well, for the time, you know, it wasn't bad.
No, they remain bad, and they probably were kind of bad even back then. But for grindhouse films,
yeah, there you go.
They were great,
right?
It was also noteworthy because it came out of Troma Productions or Troma Studios, and it led to a whole line of Toxic Avenger movies and schlock in general, which is basically like some crazy horrible thing has happened, but we're not going to dwell too much on that. Let's see where the action takes us.
Yeah, exactly.
So like Bad Taste, the Peter Jackson's uh-huh. first film,
right,
is a great example of schlock that came out of Toxic Avenger.
And he had the film that followed Peter Jackson, Dead Alive, which was at one point supposedly the goriest film ever made.
Really?
Although it sounds like your new Korean movie has surpassed that.
Yeah. I think it probably has. I haven't seen Dead Alive. I've seen Bad Taste, and Bad Taste was horribly gory, but I think this has it beat.
Yeah, but I bet you if anything, I mean, I haven't seen the one you're talking about, but is it more realistic gore?
Yeah, with Bad Taste, it's really like these are aliens that are having their heads blown off, so that definitely takes you at least a degree away from caring.
Right.
This is happening to human beings in I Saw the Devil.
Gotcha.
So it definitely is driven home a little more.
Well, and the violence, even the gore back then, it was so over the top, right out of Fangoria magazine. It's like, you know.
Dude, Fangoria is still around.
Is it?
Yeah.
I figured it was.
I'm glad it is. We follow it on our Twitter feed.
Oh, we do?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, like a head will explode in Scanners. And, you know, it's not disturbing because it's so clearly over the top. But these new movies are much more disturbing, if you ask me.
I agree wholeheartedly because they're more realistic.
Yeah.
So carrying on with Chuck's and my Siskel and Ebert act. this is the second-to-last movie in our little list today. And this one's from way back from the 30s, so let's talk about Reefer Madness.
These high school boys and girls are having a hop at the local soda fountain. Innocently, they dance. Innocent of a new and deadly menace lurking behind closed doors. Marijuana, the burning weed with its roots in hell. Or watch case.
If you want a good smoke,
Try one of these.
You will meet Bill, who once took pride in his strong will as he takes the first step toward enslavement.
So that was the excellent Reefer Madness, which was an exploitation, a drug exploitation film.
Yeah.
And very much a cautionary tale. It even shaped the drug culture and how people looked at drugs as, you know, marijuana at the time is this really evil thing that can make you crazy and kill people.
Yeah. And actually, in very much the vein of early exploitation films, it was produced and distributed as a public service. Like the okay. alternate title for it was Tell Your Children. And the whole thing set in a PTA meeting
right.
where this guy is relating the story.
Uh-huh.
And it's a story about lost lives, about murder, about guilt and paranoia. And all of it is fed and based on rampant drug use, which is really just a lot of pot smoking, which can turn you into a fiend. And it's apparently the director, his name is Dwayne Esper.
Uh-huh.
He did other exploitation films from the 30s like Sex Madness,
right.
Psychotic Connections. And he made a name for himself basically taking these things that may have originally been written as a public service.
Right.
And making them so outlandish that he exploited the people who were making these movies.
Right.
And created this legacy of like just insanely over-the-top exploitation films from the 30s.
Well, and ironically, Reefer Madness, years later, would become not so much an anti-drug propaganda film, how should I say this, but a film that college students would sit around and watch while partaking and laughing at this whole thing.
Yeah.
And a cult film.
Yeah, because it puts drugs so far out there that if you, despite all the warnings, take drugs anyway, and you realize that you don't turn into a fiend and murder somebody, Reefer Madness basically dares you to go further. So it's kind of it's the opposite. It has the opposite effect of what I think its original intent was before yeah. Dwayne Esper got his hands on it. And as a side note, I had trouble deciding between Reefer Madness and another 1930s film by a guy named Todd Browning called Freaks.
Oh yeah. Well, that was huge because it was the first big exploitation film pre Hays Code and last.
Yeah.
First and last.
And it was an MGM film.
Yeah.
And it's widely considered a masterpiece.
Yeah, I mean it looks great. It was well done.
It's a huge it's a revenge movie, which uh-huh. is a very common theme in exploitation films.
Yeah.
Especially violent ones. But it featured Browning dared to have real freaks, I guess, if you'll...
Yeah,
if you'll,
circus sideshow freaks is
yeah,
what it was about.
Star in this,
uh-huh.
And they basically exact their revenge on people who've mistreated them.
Yeah.
And I have not seen it. Have
oh,
you?
Really? Yeah, yeah.
I want to. I hear it's just awesome. I can't
it's
wait.
It's good. It ended his career, though, unfortunately.
Did it really?
Yeah. No, and he was a popular filmmaker at the time.
Well, hats off to him for staying true to his art. Chuck just took his hat off.
Don the old cap.
All right, Chuck, here's the last one that we've got a clip for, which I think everybody will notice or recognize. Without even a word, there's not even a word in this clip, and you will understand what's going on. So
right.
Here we go.
So, Josh, those are the unmistakable sounds of Fist of Fury of Mr. Bruce Lee.
Bruce Lee kicking bottom.
His first movie.
Yeah, which was originally titled, well, it's still titled, I think, in Asia, The Big Boss. In America, it's titled Fist of Fury.
Yeah, it was on the other night on cable. I saw part of it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I didn't realize it was his first one, though. I would have tuned in.
Yeah, and it was first of what, five? Five major films.
Right.
And basically it's the story of a martial arts student who's investigating the murder of his teacher. And it began the martial arts exploitation subgenre.
Which later would become just martial arts films, right? Or was it still considered exploitation?
It's all the same.
Okay.
They're one and the same.
Gotcha.
Anything that even remotely resembles a Bruce Lee movie, specifically The Big Boss, or any of them is martial arts exploitation technically. Because, again, we arrive at that one definition. It's over the top. Like Bruce Lee's taking on scores of anonymous thugs
For 2 hours.
One after the other for 2 hours, just beating the tar out of all these people without tiring, really.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's kind of waiting their turn politely in a circle around him, and he has to beat everybody.
Right.
And then he works his way up, and it's over the top. So it is exploitation, but it led to other films like Samurai Exploitation. Remember American Ninja? Remember the whole ninja film thing that came out in the mid-'80s?
Uh-huh.
That's from Bruce Lee's... that's Bruce Lee's doing.
Well, yeah, and you go to these, at the time when I was first going to New York many years ago, there would be, you know, you go to Times Square, and this is still when Times Square was kind of gross, and there would be just the martial arts movie store where it was all that stuff, man, like thousands of movies about ninjas and samurais and martial artists, and very big.
Yeah. I was inspired by American Ninja to become a ninja. Remember, I entered ninja training with Tommy Roper. Who had like more throwing stars than any kid I've ever
known. Right. Yeah. What, did you have like one throwing star?
I borrowed his.
Okay.
I was not allowed to have throwing stars of my own.
Oh, I wasn't either.
Yeah.
Baptist, no.
No.
That was very violent. No nunchucks.
I think that even,
nothing like that.
That transcends like religious background. It's like, if you're a good parent, you shouldn't let your kid have throwing stars.
That's a good point. And as you pointed out in the article, this actually led to another subgenre, which was Bruce Lee lookalike movies.
Yeah, so he made five movies
then
died at age 32
in
1973. So Big Boss released in 1971. He dies 2 years later. Everybody's like, no! So let's find some guys that look like him, which is really kind of stereotypical and racist for the West. But
let's name him Bruce Lee, L-I,
or
L-E-E.
Or L-E.
Or just L-E?
Well, Bruce L-I or Bruce L-E.
Right.
I don't think there was ever like Bruce L-E-I-G-H. I don't think it ever got that far. But I mean, they released dozens of Bruce Lee, and I just made air quote, films.
Yeah.
So Bruce Lee created the martial arts exploitation genre and subgenre, and he inadvertently created the Bruce Lee exploitation subgenre of the martial arts exploitation subgenre.
By dying young.
Yeah.
And being very popular.
Yeah.
And which one was the one he had Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in? Was that Enter the
Enter
Dragon?
Enter the Dragon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you've never seen a like 7-foot-plus guy do martial arts, you should check that out.
And if you can't get enough Bruce Lee and you have a good sense of humor, check out Kentucky Fried Movie.
Yeah.
Made by one Jerry Zucker,
right, Jerry Zucker,
who we met in Los Angeles recently.
And
who used an expletive to me.
He did.
It was one of the high points of my life.
It is.
But yeah, Kentucky Fried Movie, awesome.
Actually, when we met Jerry Zucker, we told him that our little speech we were given that night was one of the highlights of our career thus far.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, it doesn't say much about your career, does it? Like the first thing the dude does is say something funny.
And we just like kind of fawned over him after that.
We should mention briefly, and it's in the article, but just as a teaser, the late 70s, we got Nazi exploitation movies.
Nazi exploitation.
As a subgenre.
Yeah.
And one of the major players there, movie-wise, was Ilsa She-Wolf of the SS.
Yeah, which led to Ilsa... Siberian Tigress and Ilsa, Harem Keeper of the Oil Sheiks.
Really?
There's a whole sex violence franchise, dominatrix franchise, that was based out of the Nazi exploitation film.
You know, one could argue that QT, Mr. Tarantino, has made nothing but exploitation films since Pulp Fiction. Because the Kill Bills were definitely martial arts exploitation.
Definitely.
The Jackie Brown was a riff on... on
blaxploitation. Sure.
Death Proof, obviously. That was what they were trying to do there.
Well, Death Proof is carsploitation, which follows in the tradition of Vanishing Point.
Right.
Which was released the same year as basically its rival to the founding movie of carsploitation, Two Lane Blacktop.
Right. Which, great movie.
Yeah. If you want to start an argument with an exploitation film buff, tell them Vanishing Point was the beginning of carsploitation. They'll get mad at you.
And then finally, Tarantino with the Inglourious Basterds, which is clearly a riff on the Nazi exploitation films.
Yeah.
Beating Nazis to death with a baseball bat. That's about as over the top and lurid as
it gets. It's awesome. Yeah. And then Machete. I hated it, but Robert Rodriguez, it's terrible.
And of course, he was the other half of the, Rodriguez was the other half with his Planet Terror of the Grindhouse double feature.
Yeah, okay.
And Machete was born from one of the little fake trailers they made in that movie.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, it was one of the fake movie previews.
It is, even as far as like a purposefully B movie.
Not good.
No.
Well, Death Proof was okay, but I didn't like Planet Terror that much.
Yeah. And then Chuck, well, first of all, before we get to today, we also have to give a shout out to pornos. Porno came out of the exploitation film genre.
And it arguably had a lot to do with killing or pushing it into the mainstream, because once you had the movie Deep Throat and all of a sudden a pornography was on the screen,
mm-hmm.
it's like you can't do an exploitation film about it anymore. If there's the real deal going on, it loses all its power.
Right.
And then a little movie called Jaws came along,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden a quote-unquote B-movie style movie made gobs and gobs of money. And that put a little bit of mainstream respectability on the map all of a sudden. And so one might argue, Josh, that movies like Jaws and pornography
mm-hmm.
kind of shoved exploitation films, even though they still exist. They're sort of mainstream movies now.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I guess another word for grindhouse these days is blockbuster. Jaws was the first blockbuster movie, summer blockbuster. And now you have to have summer blockbusters, and they're always over the top.
Right.
And exploitive of viewers' tastes.
And not only Tarantino, there's other filmmakers out that are trying to capture that 70s vibe mm-hmm. with overt exploitation films mm-hmm. again. Shot that way, shot on 16 millimeter film, stuff like that.
Yeah. So, Chuck, I say our message to everybody is, number one, go onto the site, read 10 noteworthy exploitation films. Number two, if that interests you, like even the 10 noteworthy exploitation films I chose don't cover even, I think, a third of the exploitation subgenres. So there'll probably be another article forthcoming at some point. If there is, we'll let you know. And then go watch some exploitation movies and enjoy them.
Yeah, watch the documentary American Grindhouse, too, if you're into that.
Yeah, it's a great one. It's free on Hulu, actually.
That's right.
There's ads, but Hulu.com has American Grindhouse for free. It is not safe for work.
No.
In no way, shape, or form. I was watching it at work, and I was like, whoa, okay.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you are watching it at work, tabbed browsing is what you want to be doing.
Right.
And keep your finger over the mouse and keep the cursor over the other tab.
Right.
And stay sharp.
Or in our case, you can just say, it's research. But you can't do that if you're an accountant at J.P. Morgan.
You're just a sicko, weirdo.
That's right.
That weird guy in accounting. So look up 10 noteworthy exploitation films. You can type that into the handy search bar at howstuffworks.com. If you want to follow us, we have our own Twitter feed. Seriously, it's called SYSK Podcast. One word.
10,000 strong plus.
Yeah. We're on, we're up to like 11 and change.
That's plus 10.
That's true. we're also on Facebook, facebook.com/stuffyoushouldknow.
Yep.
We have a Kiva team, right? We're trying to get to $500,000.
That's right.
That's kiva.org/team/stuffyoushouldknow. And then you can always send us a good old-fashioned email. We want to know what your favorite exploitation film of all time is. You can send that in an email to stuffpodcast@howstuffworks.com. Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh. That's Chuck.
Coming to you from Studio 1A.
Yes, deep within the bowels of How Stuff Works corporate headquarters.
That's my spokesman voice.
Yeah, that's pretty good, Chuck.
No, it's not.
Chuck, do your best monk.
Like a Franciscan monk chant?
I don't care.
No. I know what you're talking about. You're talking about Monk, the TV show.
Yes.
One of my favorites.
Is it?
Yeah, I love it.
You watch it?
You don't?
Yes, I do.
No, it's good. I watch Monk because, let me go ahead and set this up. I have, in a very, very offhand way, know Monk.
Let's hear it, Chuck.
I don't know him. I've met him a few times. Tony Shalhoub, the actor, the great, great actor, Tony Shalhoub.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not just saying that because I've met him. I really, he's a big fan of his work with the Coen brothers, especially.
Yeah, he's pretty good in their films.
Yeah,
they know
really
how
great.
To direct that guy.
Yeah. I met Tony through a friend of mine who was a director and who had worked with Tony. And Tony's a really good guy. He took a shine to my friend Jim and went to his wedding even, which I went to. And Tony's read one of my screenplays, was kind enough to do that. And
wait, you went to Monk's wedding?
No, I went to my friend Jim's wedding, okay, and Monk was there. But
sure,
when I was there, I thought it was kind of funny that, you know, I knew he was going to be there, but there was a lot of, you know, periphery family there, and I just wondered if people just kind of flew in from out of town, and sat down. They're like, hey, you know, what's Monk doing here?
Yeah, I'll bet.
He's over there. I just see him. He's right there.
Yeah, he's an online registered minister.
Yeah. So I sort of have met Tony a few times. He's a very nice guy. We got way sidetracked here.
Oh, we did. Yeah. We did. And actually, if we had OCD, that would not stand.
Right. Man, that was good.
Thanks.
Like Monk, OCD. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah, that's where Monk came from. So basically, let's discuss OCD today.
Which stands for Obsessive Compulsive Disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think most people probably realize that.
Yeah, which seems kind of foreign to me. I've...
Not me.
I can kind of identify with it, but mm-hmm. I mean, the thought of actually being clinically diagnosed with OCD and living the way that
right.
that people who have OCD live,
mm-hmm.
I can't imagine it being bearable. I guess that's probably what I should have said.
Right.
You can identify?
Well, I often say I have OCD just to my wife as a joke, but I do have a lot of really weird, quirky, compulsive habits, but... After reading the article and doing a little more research, I realize unless it's an actual compulsion that you have to right. do it over and over and over, then it's not actually OCD. It's just weird, quirky habits.
Like what?
Oh, boy. Really?
Yeah.
Wow. I never really told people a lot of these. I don't step on stairs that have something on them.
Okay.
I will try to avoid cracks on the sidewalk, but not only yeah. that, but if I step on a crack with my left foot, then I have to step on the next one with my right foot.
Wow.
I know. I might have OCD, actually.
That's entirely possible. It sounds like, though, it's not, it doesn't run your life.
Well, that's the difference. I think OCD would be if I stepped on the crack with my left foot and then missed the next one with my right foot, I'd have to go back and then do it all over again. And it doesn't come down
or
to that.
Or just chop both feet off and get it over.
Right. Yeah. And I don't always notice it either. It doesn't, you know, sometimes I'll do it and sometimes I'll notice it and sometimes I don't.
I got you. It makes me wonder, you know, what the conditions are when you notice it. Like what is going on
yeah.
in your life, what's your brain going through, that kind
Interesting.
Of thing.
Interesting. I never thought about that.
So let's give a little background on OCD. Like Chuck said, it stands for Obsessive Compulsive Disorder. Well, the obsessive part is... It's talking about the mental state.
Right.
People with OCD obsess over very slight things that seem gigantic to them.
Right.
For example, you think that your hands are dirty.
That's a big one.
That's an obsessive thought, and you can't get it out of your head. The only way to get rid of it is through compulsive behavior, say hand washing, right?
Exactly.
Here's the problem. For most of us, if we look at our hands and go, oh, my hand's dirty, I need to wash it, you wash your hand, and that's that.
Right.
You know, you may not wash your hand again for several days.
Uh-huh.
if you have OCD, you wash your hand over and over, and that obsessive thought that your hand's still dirty
mm-hmm.
Is still there.
Right. And from what I understand, it may vary with some people with OCD, but... It's not necessarily that you get to the point where you actually think your hands are clean. A lot of times there'll be a specific number in your head, like I have yeah. to wash my hands 10 times.
The magical number, right?
Yeah, the magic number, and then I can move on with my life.
And you'll see that more often with people maybe locking and unlocking doors
right.
3 times or 10 times every time, or opening and shutting or touching a doorknob or something like that.
Right, David Sedaris. The comedian and author David Sedaris, not comedian, but funny man David Sedaris.
Humorist. Yes.
He, some of his books, he touches on some of his OCD when he was a kid. It was really funny.
Yeah.
Licking light switches and licking mailboxes and things like that. It's really good.
I didn't know that licking, there was a licking compulsion.
Well, touching. And I guess he was just, licking is just touching with your tongue.
It is.
When you get down to it.
I'm going to have to try that line sometime. So, okay, so that's the background on OCD. The obsession, though,
right?
It can generally be categorized into 4 categories, appropriately enough.
Uh-huh.
You got germs, which would account for the hand washing, right?
Right.
There's symmetry, which is keeping things in place.
Right. That's where mine figures in a little bit.
Order.
Yeah. When I'm cleaning the house and things, I can't just put the remote control on the TV. I have to put it at a certain spot.
Right. I read an article in the New York Times about OCD in restaurants. Apparently, it doesn't matter how your OCD manifests. A uh-huh. restaurant is a nightmarish, hellish place.
Yeah.
There's just so many problems if you're paying attention.
Oh yeah,
you're going to really flip out.
Well, you got someone handling your food first of all.
That's a big one.
And you're eating with utensils that are shared. I mean, they're washed in theory.
Yeah,
but shared utensils. Yeah. And you know, the Jack Nicholson movie, As Good as It Gets, mm-hmm. the restaurant scene in there, I think, is pretty indicative of what the hell you could suffer through.
Yeah, well, the author of the New York Times article that I read, he was never certain that he had actually signed the check when he used his credit card.
Interesting.
So he'd look again, see that he'd signed it, and within seconds opened again and saw that he signed it, and opened it again. He would drive himself crazy like this.
Interesting.
And also he had what I think is one of the more interesting I guess manifestations of mm-hmm. OCD is reporting compulsion.
Yeah, I like this.
I love this thing.
Yeah,
this is pretty cool. Basically, if let's say you're seated at a table at a restaurant, this is the example the New York Times guy uses. If you're seated at a table in a restaurant and it's maybe a little loose, you're suddenly overcome by thoughts of, you know, either yourself or somebody else down the line who will be seated at that table being crushed by the weight of it when it falls over.
Right.
And you are overcome with the compulsion to tell somebody, the restaurant manager, a waiter, something.
Right.
And the problem is they never really appropriately react.
Right.
So I think if you feel that something's enough of a danger that it must be reported, action should be taken immediately.
So the fact that the waiter doesn't immediately take that chair and hustle it from the restaurant.
Yeah, or evacuate you from the table or something like that. Yeah, it's kind of got to be a downer. And the other problem with restaurants is that it's a very public forum. And so if you have to touch something several times before you sit down, or you change tables several times because they're not entirely stable, people notice that kind of thing, and all mm-hmm. of a sudden you're fairly embarrassing disorders put on display.
Right. So I think for that reason, a lot of times people find themselves trapped in their homes.
Yeah.
And get a little bit of agoraphobia going on.
Yeah. Apparently OCD can very easily lead to agoraphobia, right?
And baldness.
Yeah. This is awful. From what, Chuck?
From pulling your hair.
I mean, come on. What kind of an affliction is this, right?
Yeah.
This is awful. And it's all in your head. That's the worst part. And I think people with OCD realize, even before they are ever really treated, that this is all in their heads.
Right.
And that just has to make it all the worse.
Right. I know there was a basketball player in the, I guess it was the 80s and 90s. His name was Chris Jackson. I don't know if you remember him.
I remember him, yeah.
Yeah,
Spurs?
He played for LSU in college, and I can't remember where he played pro, but he had OCD and I think would tie his basketball shoes up over and over and over and mm-hmm. Be late for practice and leaving the house. He had problems leaving the house. And I'll have to look into this. This just hit me, actually. But I believe it actually had something to do with the early end of his basketball career. I may be wrong there. So,
Well,
I'll look into that.
Yeah, hopefully Jackson's still playing.
Yeah.
Because that'd suck too.
Well, he's definitely not still playing now, just because he'd be old. But
oh, gotcha.
Yeah.
Like Dr. J old?
No, not Dr. J old.
Magic Johnson old?
A little younger than Matt. Maybe he still could be playing, actually.
Latrell Sprewell old?
Yeah.
Okay, there
Latrell
we go.
Latrell Sprewell old.
I've stumbled upon it. See, that was the magical number, 3.
Yeah, we worked it out.
There's one more category that obsessions can be lumped into, and this is kind of the darkest of them all. Disturbing thoughts.
Yeah.
And these are thoughts that you can't get out of your head.
Right.
And that if they led to compulsive behavior, it's probably going to be violent, like violent sexual thoughts, other acts of violence, maybe self-inflicted or on other people.
Uh-huh.
And actually, I found a study, a case report, actually. Did you know that nymphomania is often linked to OCD?
Really?
Yeah.
That makes sense, though.
Compulsive behavior.
Yeah.
There's this woman whose case was in extremis, though. It's a 2002 case study. And there was a woman who was 23, and she was a daycare worker, but she became unemployed because her sexual activity she was so prolific that she couldn't hold a job down.
Right.
She had sex too much. And
she's in the wrong line of work.
Well, yeah, okay. So let's just settle down, Chuck.
Sorry.
So this woman actually, this is self-reported, she commonly had she had sexual intercourse 30 times in a 24-hour period,
right,
several times a week.
You sent me this in an email. I didn't realize. I thought it was just, here's an interesting fact. But she had OCD.
Yeah.
Should I be amazed at the 30 times?
Can you imagine having sex 30 times in 24 hours?
And doing it
several times a week?
No, I can't.
So this woman also had other compulsions as well, but that was a pretty interesting compulsive behavior. She was doing it to her own detriment. She derived no sexual pleasure from having sex. And she reported that, you know, she was afraid of being abandoned by these people.
Interesting.
Which took
over her life for sure.
It did. It did. And happily enough, she went under a cognitive behavioral therapy.
Right.
And is working it out.
Which is one of the treatments, along with, I believe, antidepressants is mm-hmm. one of the things they can prescribe sometimes.
Yeah, there is treatment. Take hope, all ye who have OCD and are just finding this out. There is treatment for this disorder, mm-hmm. and cognitive behavioral therapy is the chief method of
right.
curing. You want to tell them about the CBT?
Well, yeah, I know one of the methods they use in the CBT is called exposure and response prevention. And basically that's, from what I can gather, that's showing someone or putting someone in front of their fear, or in this case their obsession, and just saying you can't do it.
Yeah, imagine tying somebody to a chair, right?
Yeah.
And then putting, like, I don't know, a dirty towel on their hand.
Right.
And not letting them wash it.
Yeah.
And then basically you reinforce, look, you're not dying.
Right.
Your hand's not falling off. You're not getting sick.
And it doesn't just happen one, you know, it takes a series of,
right.
It's like breaking a wild horse.
Right. And again, through therapy and often in conjunction with antidepressants,
right.
This disorder can be licked.
Let's hope so. Not like David Sedaris licked.
Yeah, not licking being a form of touching lick.
Right. Boy, know. Full circle.
Yeah, nice one,
too. That was by accident.
All right, well, thanks for joining us this time on Stuff You Should Know. And you can learn a lot more about obsessive-compulsive disorder by typing in those three words or even OCD in our search bar on HowStuffWorks.com.
You've been listening to Chuck and Josh and the radio version of Stuff You Should Know. If you would like to contact Chuck and Josh, you can email them at stuffpodcast@howstuffworks.com. To subscribe to the podcast of this show, click on the podcast icon in the upper right-hand corner of howstuffworks.com. This is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, and online at WFMU.org.
Yeah.
Downtown Soulville Show, Mr. Fine Wine here. New time slot for the summer. Soul 45's from 8 to 9 p.m. now on Friday nights. Since the last time you heard me, a week ago, I've been out of town the entire time practically. I left first thing the next morning, came back this afternoon, and during that week, I loaded up on records. So lots of great new stuff tonight, some old favorites too. Soul 45's on a Friday night. Stay tuned.
Across the railroad track.